NATO expels 8 members of Russia's mission to the alliance, calling them undeclared intelligence officers. France says its dispute over a recent security pact between the U.S. and Australia remains serious and unresolved. And Austrian prosecutors place Chancellor Sebastian Kurz under investigation on suspicion of bribery and breach of trust. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. NATO has expelled 8 Russian representatives to the Western Military Alliance, accusing them of being undeclared intelligence officers. A NATO official has been quoted as saying that the alliance also announced it will reduce members of Russia's mission to the Brussels-based body to just 10. He stressed that the move is aimed at strengthening the alliance's deterrence in response to Russia's aggressive actions. A senior Russian diplomat has said that his country will retaliate against NATO's move. Russian diplomats have reportedly been asked to leave by the end of the month. A British news network said the NATO members decided on the expulsion after reviewing suspected Russian malign activities over the summer. Moscow has denied any wrongdoing. Political commentator Keaton Mansfield says the NATO alliance still holds a Cold War mentality which portrays Russia as a threat.
So this idea that Russia is the boogeyman, this going back to this kind of Cold War Red Scare mentality, that Russia is trying to infiltrate these, you know, quote-unquote bastions of democracy and international order such as NATO, is absolute nonsense. Russia wants world peace. It is the U.S., France, Britain, and the NATO powers that want continued instability, that want continued fighting. And that's why Russia hasn't launched new wars, but the U.S. and NATO countries do. You know, they carry out bombings every day against innocent civilians and against governments that have committed no crime or no aggression against the U.S. or NATO.
France says its dispute over a recent security pact between the U.S. and Australia, which led Canberra to ditch a submarine deal with Paris, remains unresolved and serious. Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian said the resumption of dialogue between the two countries does not mean that the crisis is resolved. Le Drian stressed the U.S. needs to show actions and not words to get out of the situation. He made the remarks despite acknowledging substantive talks with his U.S. counterpart in Paris. Presidents of the two countries are also set to meet next week. The transatlantic row was triggered after the U.S. and the U.K. inked a deal with Australia, known as AUKUS, to provide it with technology and means to build nuclear-powered submarines. Later, Canberra announced the cancellation of a multi-billion dollar submarine deal with Paris. A debate in the European Parliament underlines the extent to which trust between the EU and US has diminished. Many lawmakers say it's time the 27-country bloc learns to stand on its own 2 feet. Jerome Hughes reports out of Brussels.
We had become well used to hearing Donald Trump being slated in the European Parliament during debates, but perhaps didn't expect that his successor, Joe Biden, would also attract scathing criticism.
He did not consult us when he withdrew from Afghanistan. He completely sidelined us in the AUKUS deal.
AUKUS relates to a new military pact between Canberra, London and Washington. It means a deal involving France building submarines for Australia has been scrapped. This has created big tensions between the EU and the US. The reaction from European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen to the tensions has not gone down well.
We have a Commission President who recently proclaimed her empire, stating European military forces would be part of the solution. When will the EU recognize it is part of the problem, not the solution?
Some legislators say the EU can no longer talk about values while at the same time cowering to America.
This is a country which is ruthlessly pursuing an espionage case against Julian Assange for publishing information about US war crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq, including attempts to kidnap and kill him.
Many members of the European Parliament claim the Donald Trump era proves that EU leaders will never stand up to the United States.
For example, what did they do when Trump tried to start trade wars, took the US out of the Paris Climate Agreement, withdrew funding for Palestinian refugees and supported Israel's illegal occupation program, And what about his rubbishing of the World Health Organization amid a global pandemic?
Lawmakers say revelations that the US continues to spy on top EU politicians, officials, and institutions has also eroded trust. Experts agree.
It is absolutely central to explore ways in which trust could be reestablished across the Atlantic. Trust not only between governments, but also private sector and individuals who are very much concerned about, you know, how their data and their information is used.
Members of the European Parliament, MEPs, say Biden's failure to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal, despite indicating he would, also illustrates how the United States cannot be trusted. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
An estimated 200,000 people have demonstrated against economic austerity in France after unions called for the first nationwide strike since the outbreak of the coronavirus. Major cuts to unemployment insurance are set to go into effect despite widespread economic uncertainty and a continued increasing inequality. Rami Mazahiri has your details out of Paris.
From the yellow vests to the longest general strike the country has ever seen, France under President Emmanuel Macron has been the site of constant grassroots expression, but also shocking political repression. For the first time since the coronavirus epidemic began, France's unions called a nationwide strike, with protests taking place in over 200 cities and towns. Unions and workers are accusing politicians and bosses of manipulating the corona crisis in order to ram through more far-right economic austerity measures. Deeply unpopular cuts to unemployment insurance take effect this week, despite the ongoing economic uncertainty.
The government has used a pretext of health concerns, cut wages, to cut government jobs, to reduce worker rights, and to allow bad working conditions to get even worse. It's great to see everyone from workers to students to pensioners back in the streets again, because these cuts to unemployment are unacceptable during these tough times.
A decade of failed austerity, followed by the unprecedented corona recession, has given France's lower and middle classes a list of problems too long to fully mention. Inflation, energy prices, intense corona-related restrictions on personal freedom, unemployment, soaring inequality. But perhaps most telling is that even conservative politicians now talk of the need to, quote, make work pay, because French wages and salaries have been so stagnant for so long.
La vie a augmenté à tous les niveaux.
The cost of living does nothing but increase, and in seemingly every possible way. Costs are even higher than when the yellow vests first began. But we haven't been allowed to demonstrate. Until salaries are increased, things will continue to be more and more difficult for the French.
Protesters say that the coronavirus lockdowns and work cutbacks are too often presented as some sort of welcome and generously subsidized vacation. The reality is they have been catastrophic for many average households. The French street is alive with protest for the first time in over 1.5 years, and it may decide the outcome of Macron's re-election bid this April. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Austrian prosecutors have placed Chancellor Sebastian Kurz under investigation over alleged bribery and breach of trust. Anti-corruption prosecutors announced a probe after raids on the offices of Kurz's Conservative Party and several top aides. He's been accused of using state funds to manipulate opinion polls in favor of his party between 2016 and 2018. In a statement, the prosecutors said the chancellor and nine others were also questioned over various offenses. Meanwhile, Kurz's People's Party dismissed the raid on its headquarters as politically motivated. Earlier this year, Kurz was put under investigation for possible false statements to a parliamentary committee on corruption, but was not charged. Saudi Arabia is reported to be trying to lobby itself out of accountability for possible war crimes during its war on Yemen. We discussed this matter in length earlier with our guests in our news review program. Here it is. Now, rights activists say Saudi Arabia has lobbied heavily against a UN probe into possible war crimes committed by Riyadh and its allies in Yemen. Activists say that Riyadh is against a Western resolution which would extend the mandate of UN investigators who have documented crimes in Yemen. Geneva-based UN Human Rights Council is set to debate the motion Thursday. An expert group set up by the council in 2017 has repeatedly said the Saudi-led airstrikes and shelling may amount to war crimes. Meanwhile, a rights advocate said the UN rights body's inaction under Saudi pressure would be a stain on its credibility. Tens of thousands of Yemenis have been killed and millions displaced since Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war and imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen in early 2015. Joining us now for the program is Danica Katovich, a Yemen campaign coordinator at Code Pink, joining us from Chicago, Illinois, and Jason Inruhe, political commentator, joining us from Niagara Falls, Ontario. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess, Danica, we'll start with you. Your thoughts on this probe and what Riyadh is afraid of?
Yeah, I mean, this would not be the first time that the government of Saudi Arabia has tried to lobby themselves out of accountability. Every year, the Saudi government spends millions in the United States to evade accountability and rehab their image to the American people for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, which we just passed the three-year anniversary of. And the UN has been so useful in helping anti-war activists locate war crimes that have happened since the war or since Saudi intervention started in 2015. And I can only assume that they are trying to hide and cover up more war crimes.
Thank you, Danica and Jason. I would like to welcome you to the program. Now, Jason, this is one taken right out of the playbook of the U.S. when it came to Iraq and Afghanistan. They shut down any probe that may basically reveal war crimes by their troops in those two countries, along with the U.K. And now, are they possibly going to get behind Riyadh on this and try to help the Saudis cover up atrocities in the last 7 years committed on Yemeni soil?
I think that's very much going to be the case. So this is something that the United States has repeated more than once. It, you know, previously with Donald Trump essentially attempting to sanction the International Criminal Court, then now the U.S. is placing pressure on the U.N. and other agencies who are trying to investigate possible war crimes in Afghanistan. So I think the United States is probably going to back Saudi Arabia for much of this, given that there's been a great deal of U.S. political and military support for the ongoing crisis inside of Yemen. I mean, it's obviously that the vehicles, missiles, weapons, et cetera, were sold from the United States into the tune of more than $100 billion, I believe, that went into the Saudi Arabian military that went on to kill people in Yemen, all of which was without a doubt, I mean, there's no one that denies that what happened there and what is continuing to happen there is a war crime right now. And I think it's very likely that the United States, given the amount of culpability they have in that for supplying weapons to Saudi Arabia and political support, will probably back them in trying to keep them from being criticized.
And Danica, at the same time, it wouldn't be a surprise if the U.S. threw the Saudis under the bus, because we saw what they did with the Kurds in Syria when the Turks came into Kurdish territory. So there is a chance that the U.S. will not back an ally in a time of need. How do you see this thing playing out? Do you see accountability ultimately for the people of Yemen?
So ever since February, when President Biden announced that the U.S. was ending offensive support for the Saudi coalition, a lot of anti-war activists were excited about that, but we needed a lot of clarity about what that meant. Biden promised to make Saudi Arabia a pariah. He promised to fundamentally change the relationship the U.S. had with Saudi Arabia. But since that has not happened, the U.S. did let up on some support, but just last month, the U.S. State Department approved a up to $500 million sale in helicopter repairs to Saudi Arabia. And the U.S. continues to do diplomatic cover for Saudi Arabia. So although things have changed a little bit, I do still worry, especially that the U.S. has skin in the game in these war crimes, that the U.S. will continue to cover for Saudi Arabia.
Thank you, Danica. And Jason, we have about a minute left. Your final thoughts, please.
I think that this is going to be something that Saudi Arabia is going to get away with, at least in this immediate sense. I think that because the U.S. has been so strongly backing Saudi Arabia in its campaign against Yemen, that the U.S. is going to protect them. I mean, it's not unheard of for the U.S. to throw Saudi Arabia under the bus, but I don't think that's going to be the case this time, because it's definitely within U.S. interests for Saudi Arabia to lose any kind of independence it has so that it can join the larger imperialist bloc of the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Israel, etc. So I think it's definitely within the U.S. interest to protect Saudi Arabia from this rightful criticism. And it looks like, in my opinion anyway, it looks like a good deal of war crimes are going to go unpunished.
All right. Thank you both for joining us on the program. Danica Katovich from Code Pink joining us out of Chicago, and Jason Inruhe, political commentator, joining us from Niagara Falls, Ontario. That's a wrap for the segment of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. The Saudi Appeals Court has reportedly upheld a lengthy prison term handed to aid worker Abdulrahman al-Saddam earlier this year by a counterterrorism court. Saddam's sister, Arij, in a tweet said that the appeals court approved the initial ruling of 20 years in prison, followed by a 20-year travel ban. She said that her brother was detained in March of 2018 without warrant or charges against him. Rights groups say that he was seized after his anonymous Twitter account was breached. Saudi authorities have detained senior royals, activists, intellectuals, and clerics as de facto ruler Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has moved to crush dissent. Iran's foreign minister has voiced concern about the presence of Israel in the South Caucasus near Iran's border with Azerbaijan. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says that Tehran wants to maintain friendly ties with its neighbors, but will not tolerate geopolitical changes to the region. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
We here at IRIB English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all our listeners on the occasion of 30th of Safar, the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Reza, peace be upon him, the 8th infallible successor to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. In the limelight.
Biden is continuing former President Donald Trump's policy of misusing Title 42 in violation of U.S. treaty obligations. The Title 42 program stems from a misapplication of an obscure public health law, the Public Health Service Act of 1944, says Marjorie Kahn, journalist, in an article titled "Biden's expulsion of Haitian migrants is racist, illegal, and Trumpian." Stay tuned for more. Notwithstanding President Joe Biden's promise to pursue a more humane immigration policy than his predecessor, the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, has been illegally expelling Haitian migrants, with the Border Patrol cracking whips and herding them like cattle. When U.S. authorities put them on a plane to Haiti, they chained them like animals, hands, feet, and waist. And once they arrived, they unchained them so journalists wouldn't see them, one Haitian man told John Oliver on Last Week Tonight. When confronted about his administration's use of horse reins as whips to menace black migrants at the southern U.S. border, Biden said it was horrible to see people treated like they did. Horses nearly running them over and people being strapped. It's outrageous. Biden's denial is reminiscent of that of Barack Obama, who reacted to the 6,700-page report of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence that documented a widespread program of U.S. torture by saying that torture is contrary to who we are. But like torture, vicious beatings of black people have been sanctioned by the state throughout U.S. history. The images of U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, and Department of Homeland Security, DHS, agents on horseback whipping and assaulting Haitian refugees blatantly display the clear historical relationship between slavery and modern immigration policy, policing, and carceral state, the National Lawyers Guild said in a statement. Biden administration has expelled more than 4,600 Haitian migrants from the United States since September 19, conducting 43 flights from Del Rio, Texas to Haiti, which is still reeling from its recent devastating earthquake, flooding from a tropical storm, and a presidential assassination. Most of the people in Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince have no access to drinking water, electricity, or garbage collection. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, the International Organization for Migration, IOM, the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, and the UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, call on states to refrain from expelling Haitians without a proper assessment of their individual protection needs and urge them to uphold fundamental human rights. In their statement, they cited the escalation of violence and insecurity in Haiti, noting that at least 19,000 people were internally displaced in Port-au-Prince during the summer of 2021. In addition, more than 20% of girls and boys have been victims of sexual violence, and nearly 24% of the population, over half of them children, live below the extreme poverty level of $1.23 per day. Nearly 46% of the population, about 4.4 million people, face acute food insecurity, and 1.2 million are at emergency levels, with 3.2 million people at crisis levels. The four organizations estimated that 217,000 Haitian children suffer from moderate to severe acute malnutrition. Expelling Haitian migrants to face these horrific conditions is not only cruel, it is also racist and illegal. The whipping of Haitians by mounted Border Patrol agents was spectacularly racist, but the use of Title 42 to expel asylum seekers is equally racist and illegal and much more damaging. Attorney Brian Kankanen, a board member at the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, told Truth Out. Indeed, on September 23rd, Daniel Foote, U.S. Special Envoy for Haiti, handed in his resignation to Secretary of State Antony Blinken, stating he will not be associated with the United States' inhumane, counterproductive decision to deport thousands of Haitian refugees from the U.S.-Mexico border. Foote called the U.S. policy toward Haiti deeply flawed. Biden is continuing former President Donald Trump's policy of misusing Title 42 in violation of U.S. treaty obligations. The Title 42 program stems from a misapplication of an obscure public health law, the Public Health Service Act of 1944. The act was designed to grant quarantine authority to health officials to expel any persons, including U.S. citizens who arrive from a foreign country. Title 42 was never intended to distinguish between non-citizens who could or could not be removed or expelled from the United States, according to Human Rights Watch. plaintiffs asserted that the Biden administration's use of Title 42 to deport migrants violates the Administrative Procedure Act, the Immigration and Nationality Act, and the Public Health Services Act. In granting the injunction, Judge Sullivan found that the plaintiffs were likely to prevail on the merits of their claim that the administration's use of Title 42, which has never been applied in the immigration context, is illegal. The judge agreed with the plaintiff's contention that nothing in Section 265 or Title 42 more generally purports to authorize any deportations, much less deportations in violation of statutory procedures and humanitarian protections, including the right to seek asylum. Judge Sullivan also concluded that plaintiffs would suffer irreparable harm if an injunction were not granted, because they would be sent to their home countries, which are among the most dangerous in the world due to gang, gender, family membership, and other identity-based violence. Finally, Judge Sullivan determined that a preliminary injunction would not harm the government, and it would promote public health to quickly process, quarantine, and regulate people who arrived at the border. He accepted the plaintiff's claim that the public interest requires the U.S. to refrain from wrongfully sending people to countries where they are likely to face substantial harm. But on September 30th, a three-judge panel of D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals paused Judge Sullivan's injunction while it reviews Biden's appeal. As Lee Glarant, who filed a lawsuit on behalf of the ACLU, told CBS News, this is just the first step in appellate litigation. Nothing stops the Biden administration from immediately repealing this horrific Trump-era policy, Glarant said, adding, if the administration is making the political calculation that if it acts inhumanely now, it can act more humanely later, that calculation is misguided and of little solace to the families that are being sent to Haiti or brutalized in Mexico right now. The Title 42 policy violates the Refugee Convention, which grants non-citizens the right to asylum if they can demonstrate a well-founded fear of persecution due to race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion if they are sent back to their home countries. The Biden administration's use of Title 42 also violates the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment or Punishment, which the U.S. has ratified. That treaty contains a non-refoulement provision. It forbids sending an individual to a country where there is a substantial likelihood he or she would be subject to torture. UNHCR has confirmed repeatedly during the pandemic that expelling asylum seekers and migrants at the border without an individualized determination of the need to protect them violates the non-refoulement provisions of international law. The UNHCR Assistant High Commissioner for Protection, Gillian Triggs, stated, "The right to seek asylum is a fundamental right. The COVID-19 pandemic provides no exception."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Muslim Lady. I hope wherever you are, you're in the best state of health, wealth, and spirituality, blessed with Allah's bounties, and filled with gratitude toward the wonders of life. In the studio with me, as always, I have the honor and privilege of being accompanied by a special guest and a darling sister, Sister Razia Shamili. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
So we were talking about the verses in the Quran that explain the traditions of the ignorant Arab tribes and how they would feed the stillborn calf to their women.
There is another verse in the Noble Quran. Well, that previous verse that we read, it was from chapter 6, verse number 139, where women were considered as secondary citizens. Just for the sake of serving men, their sexual desires, just
reproducing.
Reproduction, doing cooking food and cleaning and stuff like that, right? And then there's another verse in chapter Nisa, verse number 19, about objectifying women, where it says that you can see the shameful, barbaric actions of the Arabs of the Jahiliyyah against women, mm-hmm. where the Quran says, "Oh, you who believe, you are forbidden to inherit women against their will, and you should not treat them with harshness, that you may take away part of the mahr you have given them, unless they commit open illegal sexual intercourse, and live with them honorably. If you dislike them, it may be that you dislike a thing, and Allah brings through it a great deal of good." There is so much
exactly
in this beautiful verse. Yes. There's a worldview.
Exactly.
It's not just
do's and don'ts.
Yeah, it's not just defending women's rights. It's not just equality. It's positive view to life, optimism, right? If you dislike thing, perhaps it is something that it's for your favor. Often, so many things that are going on in our lives and we become depressed, like the corona, right? I had gone to Mashhad for Ziyara, and I usually don't go inside the shrine, to the very core of it where there's the Zari.
Yeah.
Because it is always loaded with the pilgrims. I think I'm going to just wait outside and say my salam to the imam. I feel better, more connected this way, because I lose my sense of peace of mind when I go to that crowd. One of the good things about the coronavirus was that they have changed the system of visiting, you know, the pilgrimage, and they have put bars. There are like four gates coming to the Zari, to the Shrine of the Masoom, and in all these bars, women and men approach the holy place one by one, and very peacefully.
Yeah,
very in a disciplined
and orderly.
Introducing
the concept of personal space.
Exactly, and it was the first time in my whole life, throughout the course of my years of living on this planet Earth, that I went for Ziyara for once in my life, and I could actually go near the Zari. So it's like, Asan, takrahu shay'an wa huwa khayrun lakum, right?
Blessing in disguise.
Right. So being introduced to the virtual world and doing things, going to university virtually, doing things, working from home, like distant work, these had been there. But with the advent of the corona, things became so organized. People, especially in third world countries, came to think of these ways
and
options,
utilize these resources
in their practical lives.
Mm.
So the Noble Quran is just trying to say that have a positive approach, right?
Beautiful.
And even if you have a wife that you ended up with,
and you don't necessarily like her, but still
be with her
and don't mistreat her.
Appreciate her and look at her as a blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, right? So this is the view of the Qur'an.
This is very interesting, because someone once asked Imam Hassan al-Mustaba alayhi salam, "My daughter has come of age. What kind of man should I marry her off to?" And His Eminence says, "Give her to a man with taqwa, for if he dislikes her or doesn't love her, he will respect her and not hurt her. And if he loves her, he will appreciate her.
That's beautiful.
Right?
Right.
And it's exactly the embodiment of what the Quran is teaching us, that just because she's not your the woman of your dreams, and she's not your beauty, and she's not, I don't know, Gisele Bündchen or something, doesn't give you the right to abuse or mistreat her. More of that after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back to Muslim Lady here in the studio. I'm with my darling sister Razia Shamili, and we're talking about the verses in the Quran that explain the traditions of the ignorant Arab tribes.
You know, Zainab, sometimes people are so not mature and they have so little experience of the world and the people and of the rules of life that they think that who they ended up with is not the right case, or I could have been married to someone. I'm not talking about like problematic or challenging situations, I'm talking about normal place people. And then, you know, they think that if I had married someone else, I would have ended up being so happy and I would have been like that. But then, even if they go marry someone
else,
they're
going to screw it up.
It's the same story.
Yeah.
So, it's a nice general rule that wa'ashiruhunna bilma'ruf. Live with them based on the accepted customs of your time. Honorably. Honor them. Like them, right? Mm. So, it's very interesting to know that this is the viewpoint of the Quran. And I want to quote something from the second caliph, Umar bin Khattab, that he's saying that, I swear to God that in the time of ignorance, we did not count women much until Islam came and Allah determined their rights. And from then on, we realized that they have some rights upon us. Prior to the advent of Islam, people, renowned people like the second caliph, they would think that women did not even have any rights upon men. And then, interestingly, there is a beautiful hadith from the noble prophet where he says, my brother Gabriel instructed me and advised me so much about women, about respecting women, that I thought I didn't even have the right to say ah to them.
How? Which version of Islam do idiots such as Daesh and Al-Qaeda and
even ordinary Muslims,
ordinary idiotic Muslims, or those who think that they're allowed to whip their wives, which version of Islam did they receive?
Seriously.
Their prophet,
they take that
exactly.
verse.
Exactly.
And then they say, this is Islam, right?
And then their prophet is like, I think I'm not even allowed to say uf to them.
Subhanallah. And he's quoting from Jibreel.
Exactly.
Archangel.
What are we doing?
Just one of these ahadith is completely sufficient for a man to know how to treat his wife.
Exactly.
And of course, Zainab Jan, we have on numerous programs have talked about the rights of men upon women.
Yes.
That even the Quran says that فَالصَّالِحَاتُ قَانِتَاتٌ حَافِظَاتٌ. Of course, these three golden attributes, submissive women, حافظات, you can actually trust them. You can leave everything in their trust. Your children, your wealth, your dignity.
Exactly.
We're talking about
your heart.
Mutual relation. Your heart.
So. And when it comes to even the qanitat part, I don't want to drift too far away from the topic of our discussion, but when you look at within the context of how Allah describes a pious, family-oriented, adhering to the sunnah of Rasulullah sort of man, you think to yourself, well, why shouldn't I submit to him? He's kind, he's generous, he's forgiving, he's understanding, he's compassionate, he's attentive, he's family-loving, he showers me with love and attention. Why wouldn't I submit to him?
Thank you.
I was reading in the Tafsir of Tasneem, which is from Ayatollah Jawad al-Amali, regarding
life.
Yeah, inshallah, regarding the verse number 34 of chapter Nisa, where it says ar-rajalu qawwamuna 'ala an-nisa, and you know there's a debate, like, you know, this salihatun qanitat, you have to be submissive to the qawwam, right? And then it says bima fadhalallahu ba'dahum 'ala ba'd wa bima anfaqu min amwalihim. He says these two reasons have been provided for this ar-rajal qawwam. We're not saying like any kind of man is, you know, qawwam of any kind of woman. We're talking about this man that bima fadhalallahu ba'dahum 'ala ba'd. Allah has given him something, a superiority, how to manage, how to know the way to win the heart of his wife, and he provides for her. They have a romantic relationship, you know, right?
Uh-huh.
So naturally, فَالصَّالِحَاتُ قَانِتَاتٌ حَافِظَاتٌ. Why shouldn't women submit to men when it puts the load off their shoulders? You know that you can rely on him, you can trust him, that you're safe with him, you're mentally secure.
Exactly.
When you migrate to another country, you submit to the laws of those countries, even if they are the harshest, hardest laws ever, because you think that within the laws, within that government, it brings you
security.
The same is with a family.
Beautiful.
Right?
Yep, yep, yep.
Why shouldn't you submit?
Mm.
And especially because I've seen so many women, even women who have feministic trends of thought, even they like to, at the end of the day, have someone whom they can, you know, lean on sometimes.
Yes.
And, you know, who looks up, someone to look up to, and someone who cherishes their beauty.
Beautiful.
And their femininity.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, yeah,
it's an It's an intrinsic, natural feeling.
Yeah, it is. And it's a beautiful feeling, too, when it's once it's channeled in the proper way. And often I think that by qanitat, he doesn't necessarily mean that every time your husband comes through the door, you stand up and you bow for him and you kiss his hands and you brush his shoes with your shirt. He just means don't stir up drama. You know, he says something, don't necessarily try to oppose him and contradict him every second of the day, like some women do, you know.
True.
Just don't stir up drama. He says something, you're like, okay, cool. If you're not going to die, just do it. Well, that's all the time we have for today's episode of Muslim Lady. Thank you so very much, Sister Razia, darling. And thank you to our listeners for being with us. Until another greeting and salam, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illa Allah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return. La ilaha.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illa Allah.
Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He's the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
In the limelight.
The UK government, heir to a party that, like the Republicans in the United States, has not hesitated to cut social infrastructure spending and to impose austerity budgets on the poor in recent decades, promised to soup up spending on everything from cybersecurity to nuclear weapons, says Sasha Abramsky, journalist, in an article titled UK is embarking on largest military spending hike since Cold War. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Late last year, with the pandemic in full brutal swing, Boris Johnson's Conservative government in the UK announced a nearly £17 billion, what was then $21.9 billion increase in military spending. The increase spread over 4 years, represented the largest hike in defense investments since the end of the Cold War. And while it was a tiny fraction of what the U.S. spends annually on defense, made clear Britain's ambition to be seen as a global military superpower once more. In an era of escalating tensions between a U.S.-led NATO and Russia, and during a period in which economic competition between China and the West is increasingly morphing into a high-stakes arms race, Britain's move to ramp up military spending made clear that the UK won't be sitting out these new global struggles. In fact, the UK decision to escalate military investments was based on an evolving military doctrine of constant competition with adversaries that would keep opponents off balance, while hopefully staying just clear of provocations that could lead to war. The UK government, heir to a party that, like the Republicans in the United States, has not hesitated to cut social infrastructure spending and to impose austerity budgets on the poor in recent decades, promised to soup up spending on everything from cybersecurity to nuclear weapons. In March, the government announced it would raise the cap on the number of warheads the country possessed by a staggering 40%, and that it would no longer make public the number of operational nuclear weapons that it controlled. Critics argued to no avail that this would undermine the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, to which Britain is a signatory. Folded into the new, more aggressive military posture were changes that went far beyond the nuclear arsenal. Johnson's government unveiled plans for advanced new naval systems, set up a new space command, and committed to large investments in futuristic artificial intelligence. As a part of this new posture in which post-Brexit Britain isolated from its half-century-long relationship to the EU, or what was formerly known as the European Economic Community, and the power brokers on the continent, takes on increasingly confrontational military policing roles globally and regionally. The UK recently sent an aircraft carrier and broader naval strike group into South China Sea. The vessels, part of an international effort ostensibly designed to preserve freedom of navigation in contested international waters, sailed between Singapore and the Philippines, deliberately coming within a few miles of contested islands claimed by China in the region. This follows on the heels of another venture in which the UK sent a Navy strike force into the waters off Crimea, territory annexed by Russia in 2014. One can well make the baseless claim that both Russia and China are taking deeply irresponsible actions on the world stage. Yet, acceptance of that critique is different from acceptance of the desirability of giving Boris Johnson's government carte blanche to launch whatever military adventures it chooses to embark upon. In fact, Johnson's government, seeking to shore up its right-wing populist credentials, seems now to want to reach for military solutions even against recent allies. This spring, in one of the stranger post-Brexit moments, the Brits began scrambling up naval vessels against French and other EU fishers in the English Channel. The vessels were rushed off to the island of Jersey and were apparently aimed at breaking a blockade of the local waters by fishers from the continent. Irate that their long-standing right to fish these waters had now been terminated. In the end, both sides stood down, but the very notion that the UK and France could come to the edge of a naval confrontation over fishing rights, with the British government egged on by a snarling, far-right, flag-worshipping tabloid press, is simply astounding and shows exactly how far Britain has veered off course since the Brexit of 2016 set in motion the years-long process of divorce between the UK and its erstwhile partners within the European Union. French fishing vessels haven't been the only targets of the British military in the seas abutting Britain. For much of the past year, as Johnson's government has ramped up its rhetorical and legal campaigns against asylum seekers, ultra-sophisticated military drones have patrolled British waters, looking for migrants desperately trying to enter the country's waters on rafts. The arms build up, and Britain's growing willingness to needle opponents militarily is, to say the least, disconcerting, yet it isn't exactly a development out of the blue. For while Britain has, for most of its modern history, steered clear of maintaining large standing armies during peacetime, it hasn't hesitated to use its naval assets to secure global influence. In fact, in many ways, the UK's new doctrine of constant competition and ongoing military assertiveness is a souped-up version of a mid-19th century imperial doctrine, gunboat diplomacy, perfected by statesmen such as Lord Palmerston as a way to realize British ambitions around the world without actually triggering war with the other behemoth on the global stage. Palmerston was a master of the art of military populism. He routinely sent gunboats to potential flashpoints while talking about the military muscle flexing as simply being a defense of British values of liberty, democracy, and freedom. The press and much of the British public relished these shows of force, and for many years, Palmerston bestrode the halls of Westminster, first as Foreign Secretary and then as Prime Minister. He relied on Britain's raw power to impose his views, but, as importantly, he relied on bluster, in the sense that he was just gung-ho enough, just trigger-happy enough, to follow through on his threats, to convince opponents that ceding to Britain would serve their interest better than forcing an actual fight. Today, Johnson is reimagining British diplomacy in a similar way. His government pledged to cut international aid from 0.7% of the gross national income to 0.5%, and recently won a parliamentary vote on the issue, despite former Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May joining with a group of rebel members of Parliament to vote against Johnson's plan. Yet, even as his government slashes overseas aid in a cruel effort to balance a budget-falling stimulus measures designed to counter the economic impact of the pandemic, it increases military spending. Britain is now the only G7 country cutting rather than increasing its international aid commitments. It is, at the same time, spending more on its military than any other G7 member, apart from the United States, making it the fifth highest military spender on the planet. In 2020, Germany spent 1.4% of its GDP on its military, and France itself, in the middle of a significant military build-up, spent 2.1%. Britain, by contrast, spends 2.2%. This combination of withdrawal from non-military international obligations and high-profile military spending speaks volumes for the priorities of post-Brexit Britain. Moreover, it speaks volumes about the values underpinning Johnson's particularly noxious brand of right-wing nationalistic populism.
We are with you. What about you?